Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel and the all-new Opel Crossland. Beauty isn't scared of life.
First this morning, guidance for pregnant women on the risk posed by COVID-19 may have to be strengthened after more cases of virus-related stillbirths were identified. This is according to a report in today's Irish Times. Well, to talk more about this, I'm joined on the line by Professor Peter McKenna, Director of the HSE's National Women and Infants Health Programme. Good morning to you, Professor McKenna.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for joining us. Now, if a pregnant woman has read that story this morning by Paul Cullen in the Irish Times, what does she need to know?
Well, I think that it probably would be wise to start off by talking about some big figures rather than focusing on the detail just yet. In Ireland, since the pandemic began, we have had over 60,000 babies delivered. And the number of babies we think have suffered as a result of COVID placentitis is about six. So if you look at the big data...
When you say suffered now, are you talking about stillbirths?
Correct.
Okay. So you're contextualising that in order to show us how that this is a small problem, and yet it's very concerning for people who are pregnant this morning and listening to this.
Yes, and I suppose the first thing is to say this is in no way to minimise the distress that has caused the families involved, and also to say that, yes, it is a worry to pregnant women. I could see how that is the case. But it is important to bear in mind those figures of six deaths in the context of 60,000 babies having been born overall in Ireland.
So is it right then to say that you're considering whether the advice to pregnant women should be revised in light of these six stillbirths?
Well, I think it certainly would make that the general public health advice, which is to minimise contacts, applies to pregnant women even more than it does the rest of the population. I think that goes without saying. And I also think that up until this information became available, our concern was mostly with how COVID affected the pregnant woman. And again, we know that in very general terms, Ireland has done quite well in that regard. I'm not saying that no pregnant woman has not got very unwell, but no pregnant woman has died as a result of COVID. So the fact that this can affect the baby does change the emphasis a little bit. And I think it becomes even more important that pregnant women do not come in contact with COVID, or if they do, that the hospital that's looking after their pregnancy is aware of this and is able to take steps to follow them up closely.
So there's no doubt now, is there, Professor McKenna, that there is a risk to the fetus when the mother contracts COVID-19?
What we can say is that there have been six cases in Ireland where the baby has died and where the perinatal pathologist has felt that the cause of death can be linked to infection of the placenta with COVID. What, however, we don't know is how relevant this information has been to the rest of the world. It does seem strange that this part of the world, which hasn't suffered hugely from COVID, is the one part of the world where this appears to be a bigger issue than it is elsewhere.
So it hasn't happened elsewhere?
Well, babies have died as a result of COVID, yes. It is a recognised condition outside of Ireland, but in the number that we're talking about, that hasn't been recognised outside of Ireland, to the best of my knowledge.
So, I mean, what's your own view of the figures here and the evidence here?
I think that, again, it's noteworthy that these cases do appear to have happened since Christmas. And that is when we had the enormous surge in numbers, when we were talking about having four, six and more thousand positive cases per day. So it could well be that this was associated with our surge that we had after Christmas, when the infection was rampant in the community. And that being the case, one would have every expectation that we're going to see it happening a lot less from now on.
Okay. I have a text message here from a teacher who's working from home. She's just found out that she's 5 weeks pregnant after multiple rounds of IVF. Would much, much prefer to be in the classroom, but I'm afraid to return in the light of the recent medical updates, and would welcome your advice and thoughts on the risk involved for that person. I mean, would you be saying now that any woman who is pregnant, regardless of what stage they're at in their pregnancy, should not be in the workplace?
No, I don't think I would take it that far. I think that most workplaces have got an idea as to the risk involved in their workplace, and most workplaces that are open are very safe places to be. That doesn't mean to say I don't share that woman's concern. The other point to make is that the placenta isn't really functioning at this stage, 5 weeks of pregnancy, and doesn't really take over the care of the baby for a considerable number of weeks yet. And this appears to be something that happens when you have a placenta, and they say the placenta isn't developed till after 12 weeks.
So that's when perhaps people should be more concerned, after the 12-week point.
Yes, I think that advice for pregnancy will probably be for after the first trimester. That's after the first 12 weeks, the first three months.
Would you expect then that women would be urged to take more caution, particularly around the workplace?
Well, as I say, workplaces that are currently open do know the risk. And whatever the public health advice is relevant to that workplace, you've got to interpret that in the light of the individual patient.
And how do women find out if their placenta has been infected, if they themselves have had COVID-19?
I don't know that there's any way you can tell if the placenta has been infected prior to being able to examine the placenta, which happens, of course, after the baby is delivered. So
there's no way of telling?
During the pregnancy, I don't think so, mm-hmm. No. If you've had COVID, though, and it is very important that the pregnant mother would keep an eye out on the baby's movements, and if she has concerns about the baby's movements, to report these immediately to the maternity hospital that's looking after her.
I suppose all of this takes us directly to questions around pregnant women and vaccination. What's the current advice there?
Well, the current advice is that if you're in a high-risk category, a very high-risk category, and you're pregnant, say, for example, you've got heart disease or you've got renal disease or any other disease that poses a significant risk, the advice and the correct advice is that you should be vaccinated, because if you do get COVID, COVID poses a very real risk to that mother, never mind to the baby. So in terms of somebody who has a significant medical condition, the current advice, and I repeat it, I think it's the correct advice, is that that woman should be vaccinated.
Do you not think, though, in light of what you're saying this morning, that all pregnant women should be vaccinated as a priority?
No, I think that's a very big step from saying that if you have a high risk to yourself, you should be vaccinated, to going on and saying all pregnant women should be vaccinated. The reason I say this is that the condition that I'm talking about, COVID placentitis, and the impact of it, the disease has been here for 15 months, and we're only beginning to become aware of this this possible complication. So it's difficult to see how, if the disease has been here for 15 months and we're only beginning to find out about the complication, how we can extrapolate that to saying that for all pregnant women, the vaccine is perfectly, couldn't possibly have any complications. Mm-hmm. So I would say that, to use the phrase that we've heard a lot recently, an abundance of caution, I would say it's a big step from saying pregnant women at risk should be vaccinated to all pregnant women should be vaccinated.
OK, we know that the master of the Rotunda, Fergal Malone, he has said for some time that pregnant women should be moved up the vaccination priority list. You don't mm-hmm. agree with that, clearly.
I again would approach this from the point of view of an abundance of caution. I would like to see more data about the safety of vaccines in pregnant women. And as we know, there is a difference between a study about vaccination and then what happens when you roll it out to a very large population. I mean, for example, the difficulties that are being seen with the AstraZeneca vaccination weren't seen in the studies, but that now that we're rolling it out to millions of people, we are seeing some very, very rare complications. And that's really, it's from a similar standpoint, I'd say that it's, I would approach rolling it out to all pregnant women. It should be done very cautiously.
Okay, Professor McKenna, thank you very much for joining us on the programme. I'm also joined on the line by Dr. Adrian McGoldrick, GP based in Kildare. Good morning to you.
Hi, good morning, Claire.
Thank you very much for joining us. Where are you in terms of vaccine rollout now in your own surgery?
We're week after next, this day week, we start finishing off the first dose of our over 70s. We didn't receive adequate vaccine 2 weeks ago for that full cohort. We have another 350 still to do, so they will be done next week. We're also getting delivery today of AstraZeneca for our very high-risk group, but obviously we're awaiting the advice from our national vaccination body as to where we should proceed. So we got an email on Friday evening asking us to withhold giving any vaccine until we get the feedback today. But certainly for all GPs, not just our practice, we have an exceptionally busy period coming up. Until now, every second week, we would be giving vaccines to our over 70s and the week in between, taking care of our general practice. But now, in the weeks in between, we'll be giving vaccines to the very high-risk group and the high-risk group. So it's going to put a lot of pressure on general practice.
So you have AstraZeneca sitting there waiting, but you need to hear from NIAC as to what to do with it.
Yeah, well, it should be delivered sometime this afternoon, assuming everything goes to plan, yes.
OK, and you're expecting that there will be changes when NIAC makes its decision?
Because I mean, looking at the criteria from around the world, and there's no two countries with the same advice, so we really have to wait to see what NIAC tells us, and obviously we'll be totally guided by them.
Would you expect, though, that they will make changes and that this will slow down the vaccination rollout for you?
Yes, I would be surprised if they don't, in view of the UK guidance and what's happening in other countries across Europe. Certainly, I think it potentially will.
I just want to talk to you about what happened in your surgery last Monday, because you were set up and ready to go, weren't you, with your vaccines due to arrive between midday and 1 o'clock, but there was no sign of delivery, and that had a severe impact on some people who were waiting.
Yeah, unfortunately, as of this very minute, I still don't have a number to contact if my vaccines don't arrive. We get them through the cold chain Monday to Friday. Ours come on a Monday. Now, obviously, if we're a normal week, I could ring cold chain and find out what's happening, but on a bank holiday Monday, obviously they were closed, so we were due to receive them between 12 and 1. On our patients started arriving in from around 1:30. By 3 o'clock, it was very obvious things weren't going to happen, so we had to send them all home. My staff did on, and finally just after 4 o'clock the vaccine arrived, so we called people back in, gave them their vaccines, and then we cancelled our clinic for the following Tuesday morning because we were afraid we wouldn't have vaccines, so we scheduled that. So it all worked out fine. We finished our vaccines on Thursday afternoon, but Monday was upsetting, I think, more so for my patients than for us, obviously, as I was particularly upset by one patient, as you mentioned. But I think it was more upsetting for patients because these same patients, we'd actually cancelled them a month ago, again, because we didn't have adequate vaccine for them.
Yeah, there was one particular patient who was carried into your surgery.
Yeah, I mean, Jim, just use his Christian name. He's a 93-year-old man who's bedridden. I'd spoke with James' son and told him, obviously, that I would put him on the National Ambulance Service list, but he said, look, I'll physically bring him in. So he brought him in 5 weeks previously for his first dose, and no problem, brought him back in again last Monday. And unfortunately, I said, look, unfortunately, we haven't got a vaccine, so I had to bring him back home again, and we had to ring him, get him back in again. But look, he got his vaccine, and I have to say the majority of patients, and if not all the patients, really, they thought it wasn't our fault. Nothing we could do. Our hands were tied. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, every one of the patients came back in, so we didn't miss out on one vaccine on the day.
Listen, I know you're an experienced professional GP for many, many years, but to see a man of that age being carried into your surgery and then being told that the vaccine wasn't there, I know he got it later that day, but that's not easy for you.
It's not. I found it quite distressing, being very honest. I mean, I know Jim in particular for 38 years. So, I mean, he's totally bedridden, totally dependent on carers for his care. So, I mean, to see the poor man having to be brought in and then taken back home again and brought back in again, I think that's not good enough in this society, being very honest.
Mm-hmm. And you're retiring in June, but You want to continue on in some capacity, and you want to vaccinate people.
Yeah, I mean, I'm 68 last week, so I'm stepping down. I continue with my racing duties, but obviously I offer myself as a vaccinator because I'm still feel quite competent, continue working in it to a lesser degree. But, I mean, the whole process for applying for vaccination is just ludicrous. I mean, the hoops I went through, I went so far with, and I finally just withdrew my application, as many colleagues have that I spoke to, because, I mean, started off with my qualifications in medicine and then my postgraduate qualifications, but I added my birth cert, added in a full CV, whatever they need my CV for. But then when they came on to asking me to take half day off at short notice to go to Dublin for a training course in the BLS, basic life support, anaphylaxis training and how to give an injection, and then do another Garda clearance, I balked at that. Said just that, that's a step too far.
So you're out?
I'm out, yeah, as are many colleagues I've spoken to. I mean, we had to do a course online to allow me vaccinate for the HSC under the current program, so I can't see any reason why that wouldn't be adequate for me to transition over to a vaccination centre.
It would certainly seem to make sense listening to it from here anyway. Listen, we wish you well with the rollout there, Dr. Adrian McGoldrick, who's a GP based in Kildare, and also joining us now is Daniel McConnell, political editor with The Examiner. Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning, Claire.
So we have some amount of reopening today, but all of this is tempered by concerns over what happens next, really, over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, certainly. I think from the government's perspective, this is a day that they can try and start asserting their control over the narrative. You know, they've essentially been playing catch-up and reactions since before Christmas, when the virus essentially began to run out of control. So this is an important day for the government, because I think, you know, you're looking at the Fianna Fáil poll ratings, you know, they're at 11% in the national opinion polls, and, you know, they would want to see some sort of benefit. However, I suppose from a practical point of view, you know, what we're likely to see in the weeks ahead is, you know, certainly a strong desire from within government to push back against the strict public health medical advice. I don't think there was any option in the immediate aftermath of Christmas, but I do think you're likely to see the sort of arguments and disagreements we saw last year about, you know, economic considerations being weighed against the strict public health considerations coming to the fore in the coming weeks. Particularly, I think the next announcement from government in early May about the summer ahead, I think it's going to be critical. And I even saw Taoiseach Micheál Martin setting that out in a tweet this morning, saying, you know, today is an important day, but let's not jeopardise the next step, which will allow golf courses, tennis and other aspects of society to open up. So I do think that's going to be the emphasis of the messaging from government in the next few days and weeks, is let's not jeopardise the next steps. However, from a strict political sense, I do think there's a desire from within some in government to see some political and electoral benefit from it, because certainly they're not seeing any of it so far. Mm-hmm. And there are some within government who are sceptical that they will see any benefit. I think, you know, some people are, you know, they clearly see the fact that they're being blamed for what happened at Christmas. And why would the public, you know, reward them for taking 3 or 4 months to fix the problem?
Yeah, the NIAC announcement today on what happens with AstraZeneca, that's likely to have a big impact on reopening and the vaccination rollout too.
Yeah, it's certainly going to have an impact. I think the way it was being described to me this morning, it's likely to impact the sequencing rather than the totality of the numbers of vaccines that we're going to get. So it may cause short-term turbulence, so to speak, in terms of, you know, reprioritizing certain categories of people. But I think if we step back, you know, the Pfizer vaccine is by far the biggest one in terms of scale and volume. You have the Johnson & Johnson coming on stream. So the AstraZeneca one is not maybe as critical, maybe as some have suggested, but undoubtedly there will be an impact. But I don't think, you know, certainly talking to a number of medical people over the weekend, they're not as, say, downbeat as say, some others may be.
And these additional countries then on the mandatory hotel quarantine list, 16 of them, they'll be on the list from Thursday. Now, the minister was asked this morning, the Minister for Health on Morning Ireland, about why there was the delay there. And he explained that it's to give people time to book into the system, to book into these hotels. Is that reasonable?
Yeah, I mean, on one level you can see that makes sense, but on the other level all it means is that there's going to be a flood of people coming here before the mandatory quarantine system kicks in, and we're already seeing that, you know what I mean? So I think it was a difficult one either way, but again, I just think the mandatory quarantine system from the get-go has been mired in sort of competency question. You know, there's been clearly a resistance from within the political establishment, the civil service establishment. Nobody wants to touch this. They've been dragged to this position by the public, you know, who demand demanded this after Christmas. You've even seen that, you know, Stephen Donnelly, his department didn't want to take control of this, but yet essentially were, I won't say dumped with this, but certainly were left with no other option but to take this on because other members of government didn't want to take it upon their own bailiwick. So the government's resistance to this has been considerable, and you know, I think there's been a cost to that, because I definitely think you're seeing issues about the competency of the rollout, the time it's taken to get this up and running, and also as well we're seeing operational issues about people walking at the door of hotels, etc. like that, and not really being challenged appropriately.
And Daniel, the other matter he was asked about on Morning Ireland was the tweets, the story in the Irish Times today about the minister or someone working on his behalf complaining about the fact that his name wasn't included in Department of Health tweets earlier in the year. Now, what did you make of his response to the question when it was put to him on Morning Ireland?
Yeah, he kind of said he hadn't read the story, which I find, if I, like, to be honest with you, I don't necessarily think it's credible. You know, at 8 o'clock or after 8 o'clock on a Monday morning, when you know you're going on, you know, a key program like Morning Ireland about a story that's on the front page of a key newspaper, which I'm sure his department would have been asked queries about before publication. I just don't see that as any way really credible. Clearly it's an embarrassing story. It makes him look like a bit of a diva in terms of looking to see that, you know, his priority or his standing is sort of emphasised. Now, you could say as a politician that's his job, is to ensure and control his own messaging around him, but given the workload he has on his plate, given he's in control of not only the HSE but the quarantining and also the vaccine rollout, he's a lot on his plate. So this idea that he's concerned about, you know, the number of mentions he's getting on the social media platform does raise a few eyebrows without question.
All right, Daniel, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Daniel McConnell there from The Examiner. We'll speak to the Green Party chairperson and Lord Mayor of Dublin, Hazel Chu, after the break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.